CliffCentral.com.
Let's see. Gareth van Onselen, who we had on the Burning Platform last week, he's just written a piece called How South Africa's Universities Reward Their Torturers. One of the most powerful unseen parameters that constrains academic freedom is the idea homage must be paid to the ANC. And they do. They give off like, they give out these honorary doctorates to people like Jacob Zuma, who is clearly not a fan of education. But here's an interesting comment. I love this. Andrew sent me an email. You know, we get to meet interesting people on the show. Andrew said, "Hey Gareth, last week's Burning Platform, Canthan made a throwaway comment about turning Zoo Lake into a reservoir. As you are a student of history, you might want to know about the history of why that's not possible. My great-great-grandmother's cousin was a guy called Herman Eckstein. He was one of the landlords who bought a little farm called Bromfontein to prospect for gold. After finding no minerals, he started planting trees, estimated over 3 million trees. This became a recreational area for the other landlords. Just before his death in 1883, he sent his young wife back to England, leaving his only living relative, Edith, my great-great-grandmother, in South Africa. There was some sort of fallout between them, because despite so much wealth, he only left her a solitary ring in his will. However, 10 years later, his business partners, to honor his wishes and bring reconciliation after two brutal Anglo-Boer wars, donated the land to the city of Johannesburg. The land was split into the suburbs of Saxonwold, in honor of his German roots, and Forest Town, because, well, the trees. 20 acres for infantry establishment, and 200 acres for the express purpose of recreation for all the people of Johannesburg, irrespective of race. That is the reason why Johannesburg has a war museum, built on the infantry site. His peers clubbed together and bought additional land to make a promenade, but that got turned into Lower Park Drive. Zoo Lake is surrounded by sports clubs built on the land, keeping with the wishes of his estate. In fact, everything non-recreational, or if anyone, a citizen of Johannesburg, is prevented from making use of the facilities, the contract would be breached, the land would revert back to his estate. So even through the dark days of apartheid, everyone was entitled to use Zoo Lake, and there were never any arrests of people of color there. It is a rare jewel in our city, given generously, and a place we should all respect. So sorry, Canthan, a reservoir for Parkview is off the cards." That's from Andrew. But what a lovely story. Isn't
well,
that nice?
I love that story, but I did not make that comment.
Didn't you?
No.
Someone else?
It was someone else, clearly, but I'm very happy to have that piece of history. Thank you.
Yeah, I love that. That's fascinating to hear. There's over 100 years ago of history. So this morning, it is time for, once more, the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. I just have to say, Nando's were involved in our Pure Conversations last night, and they brought so much chicken. My God, Sia, we're going to hand out chicken all day today, right?
Yeah, this is the chicken like one stop shop.
Yeah, so we had
My goodness, we had
Pure Conversations last night with Bonang and Unati and Maschaba and Kuli, and we had a really, really interesting 2-hour chat with the ladies. It was fascinating, and Nando's were very much a part of it. So a big thank you to them. And this morning, Nando's brings you the Burning Platform, which is our opportunity to catch up on politics, society, the economy, all the things that are going on in current affairs. We're joined this morning by Canthan Pillay and Kayas Tole, our returning champion. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that are going on in the news. Good morning, Kaya. How are you?
All good. I see the chicken is making its way to some people's waistlines. But yeah,
oh, thanks very
out.
Much. You're saying I'm looking fat.
I missed out. I'm feeling jealous.
You know what? We've got some for you.
Oh, thank you.
So before you leave, we'll sort that out.
I'll take that offer.
All right. So, gentlemen, it's never a quiet week in South Africa, but this week there's this to talk about. International Relations Minister Naledi Pandor is expected to meet with members of the African diaspora in Pretoria last Friday. We don't know how this went, but it came after recent attacks against foreign nationals in and around Gauteng, led to the deaths of 12 people, the looting of shops. The president has appointed special envoys to 7 countries, including Nigeria, to repair the damaged relations after the violence. So, we know we have a problem.
Who are these envoys?
Jeff Khadebe.
I thought that this was going to be Jeff Khadebe.
Yeah, it's Jeff Khadebe and two other people.
What has Jeff Khadebe got that he has been in constant service of the government? He's probably our longest serving minister of all time, and now when he retires, he gets pulled back in as an envoy.
Well, currently he's missing a job, so I think he...
So they just found him something to do.
Yeah, but also quite interestingly, one of the envoys didn't get permission because I think he's serving at the UN, and then it turned out that he didn't have permission to leave that job and come and do this envoy thing. All of this, of course, is absolute rubbish because you have ambassadors whose job it is to go and mend those relations. So all of this optics that the president plays when he says he appoints envoys, remember some of them were there to get us investment, how many jobs has that created, and now there's these ones who go around apologizing for things that, let's face it, when you come back and then you say, so 12 people lost their lives, how many of them were South Africans, how many of them are foreigners?
I can hand over at this point to Kaya's cynicism. My job is done.
But can I ask you quickly, what would we find, do you think, if we did an audit of our diplomatic corps? Because a lot of these ambassadorial jobs, which are important because we know that the value of diplomacy is that in a tight situation, your ambassador is meant to be able to help both countries to repair damages. They're also meant to encourage trade. I deal with a lot of the people from foreign governments who are in South Africa who are encouraging and getting involved in projects. And, you know, they really do get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
They get into business. They get into cultural exchanges, all kinds of things. I don't know that our diplomatic service do that. It seems to me that a lot of the people who are ambassadors are appointed because they are, you know, like so many people in the bureaucracy, cater deployed, or because it's a reward for service, or because it's because you come from one of the struggle families, something like that.
Let's remember the historical context for ambassadors. The ambassadors were there basically as potential hostages, so that in the event of anything actually going down, you were inclined to behave yourself simply because your ambassador was, you know, likely to be executed or worse. You know, hence the thing about recalling ambassadors was tantamount to a declaration of war.
I can give you three names.
All right.
Sbu Ndebele, Stone Sizani, and Obed Mlaba. What's common about them? If you mess up in this country, we're going to find a post for you to go and be our ambassador elsewhere. Remember Norman Mashabane?
Yes.
Yeah, he had this habit of, you know, having his way with the women at the embassy, and the ANC kept reposting him. So the problem that we have, of course, is we don't know what underpins the process of forwarding these people to all these countries. Are these the people that you look at and then you say, hey, Stone Sizani, you look like the best person who can go and represent us, and I think he's in Germany right now, right? Particularly because we've just found that your wife has this habit of fraudulently creating fictitious teachers and then stealing all their funds. So she's been convicted of fraud, and then you send her husband to Germany to represent your country. I'm hoping at all the ambassadors' dinners, nobody says, how's your wife doing? Because it must be a very awkward conversation.
You know, these are important relationships to keep warm as well. We're very dependent on foreign trade and direct investment. Cyril has made a huge overture to trying to get us foreign direct investment. And these are the people who do the heavy lifting once he's left the country, once the summits are over, once the grandstanding is done. They're meant to make sure that these deals happen.
Yeah.
So they have to be effective people.
Yeah, ideally they should know what they're doing. But I suppose we always have to distinguish between the political appointments and the proper appointments. So in most of these instances...
Wait, go back. Proper appointments.
Yeah, the people that actually know the job.
Give me an example of it.
Well, maybe they don't exist, but let me finish. So, you know, that is a problem that the ambassador himself, that's a political appointment. Now the question is, do the bureaucrats that sit behind that ambassador actually know their jobs? And if those people know their job very well, then perhaps the ambassador's scope for messing up essentially is minimized. And I think in South Africa, we don't interrogate that because I think we're not going to get away from the fact that political appointments exist. And we still don't have a framework for saying that if a person is going to be a minister of this portfolio, for example, what are the baseline requirements that we can say, okay, this person is suited for that purpose. It really just becomes a very random and a very arbitrary process. So because we're stuck with those random and arbitrary processes, our best defense is to then ensure that the people that actually do the work at least know what it is that they're doing. And unfortunately, we don't have an objective way of evaluating what it is that
they're doing. So in other words, we could be just like so many other things. We could be paying for something that really delivers nothing.
We are paying for something that delivers absolutely nothing.
So let's shut it down. I mean, you know, these days, thanks to the internet, I mean, it's possible for Cyril to just hop on the phone also at any time and get onto Skype or talk to Angela Merkel down some safe line. Do we really need an ambassador? Because we're paying for probably quite a lot of luxury and unnecessary nonsense in these countries too, right?
Look,
And the UN. I mean, let me ask you about the UN. Do you guys, how are you feeling about the UN?
Was it Jens Maats in 1945 that went over to champion the UN human rights thing, and then it turned out that he couldn't stand himself because his country was not going to stand up for championing human rights? I think we were one of the founding.
We were.
You know, so the UN has always
been. I think the UN was Jens Maats' idea, the League of Nations.
Yes, the League of Nations. That's where it all started. And look, the very first question, do we need these things? I suppose at the end of the day, we have to go back and ask ourselves difficult questions. You've created all these embassies across the world because you believe that the only way to facilitate trade is for someone to be physically there to actually say, please go and invest in South Africa. Now, as you said earlier on, we live in a very different world where a person doesn't need to go to the ambassador's house or ambassador's office to find out what's happening in South Africa. These people themselves hire very expensive consultants and bankers to tell them exactly what the conditions are in a particular domicile before they decide to invest there. So I think that perhaps the role that the ambassadors play in facilitating trade has been severely overstated. I personally wouldn't go to an ambassador and say, should I invest in that country? Because, well, that's the person who represents that country, so of course they're going to say yes. So that person will say, yeah, never mind that war you heard about yesterday. Tomorrow there'll be an opportunity to build a hospital, so therefore go and invest in that country. So I think you have people who themselves are not going to tell you the true story. So if you have R1 billion, for example, to invest, are you really going to trust the word of a Stone Sizani, for example, or Oben Mlaba, because they're going to say, yes, go and invest there. And then you come back here and then you realize that actually perhaps the climate for investment was not appropriate at that point in time. So I do think that their role as facilitators of trade is simply overstated.
Yeah, do you feel that we could curtail some of those activities and we could cut costs there?
Yes, but there are so many other things where we could cut costs. We could just start with cutting down the sheer volume of ministers that we have, because we have departments that actually don't do any work. But
Which ones are particularly egregious to you?
Well, let's take Ibrahim Patel's portfolio as an example, which is basically responsible for economic development, but he doesn't understand economics and there's certainly been no development. So let's use that as a starting point. Let's take Ministry of Women as another example. By every conceivable measure under the ANC, women have gone backwards in terms of their fundamental human rights. So let's eliminate that one because it clearly doesn't do anything. Oh, then let's go to education because, you know, clearly...
That into two.
Yes. Well, didn't we actually...
I don't know if it's been re-amalgamated. I'm not sure.
I think we did kind of squoze back on some of those things. Well, I don't know. Where do we start?
There's science and technology. There's... possibly we should also get rid of sport and recreation, since I think people can take care of those things themselves.
Very much so.
I don't know. You keep arts, culture.
Yeah, there's a lot of these ministries where perhaps the business case for having a standalone ministry has not been established. And I think when you talk about that that business case, you'll be asking yourself...
But Kaya, the business case for government has not been established.
Yeah, when somebody has to be in charge of something. So I think in that regard, because we actually don't even know what the expectation is from society or even from the government itself, the president can come up tomorrow with a brand new ministry and absolutely nobody's going to say, no, you can't do this, because then he'd be like, well, why didn't you say so when I created Ministry X and Ministry Y? So that becomes a key issue that we are facing, in that we don't really know what the proper role of these things are. We know, of course, that we need to have some government agencies that facilitate particular things. Now, whether the way we've structured it is the most ideal way, given the type of challenges that we have and the inability of some ministers in particular to deal with those particular challenges, that becomes the enduring problem that we have. We've seen in the past that when you wanted to employ as many comrades as you could, you simply split a ministry into two or three. Now there's been some clawback on that, so now energy and mineral resources seems to be converging, and then there's a new department, and I'm actually the only person who calls it the heist department.
The heist department?
Yeah, it's heist, because it's higher education, innovation, science and technology. So it's the heist department and nobody calls it that. And I think it's a missed opportunity that you have a department that is actually called the heist department in this country. So there's been that amalgamation, but basic education and higher education remain separated for reasons that are difficult to reconcile with anyone who's not a politician. So we do have that particular problem that we still don't know what the benchmark is for creating these things.
Can we quickly go back to this xenophobic stuff? It seems to have died down to a degree, but we still have this underlying problem, which hasn't been addressed, which hasn't been... solutions have not been proposed, particularly not by government. But we know that there are many people who live in this country, and we had scores of them heading out not so long ago during the height of this violence. How do you think our position in Africa currently lies? How do you think we're currently...
It's exactly the same way it's been for the past 25 years. everyone on the continent north of the Limpopo actually hates us. And now they actually have contempt reasons for us, yes. And, you know, by and large, if you consider north of the Limpopo, nearly every country on this continent is outperforming us economically. So if you just simply take the trajectory in terms of where it is right now, ultimately, Africa north of the Limpopo is not going to need us.
Yeah, and therefore we won't want those people who are now living here, that they won't want to be here very much longer.
Very so much so,
it'll
yes
sort itself out.
Yeah, look, I think the perception of South Africa across the continent is not particularly favorable. We are still seen as very arrogant in some regards. And I think what we do have as a problem here is that our people don't travel widely enough. So when you speak to some people and you ask them about, you know, their perceptions about people from other parts of Africa, they don't really know what to say or how to engage with them. So I think that feeds into this trust deficit, if you want to call it that, where people are simply saying, well, the problem is that I don't have a job, and yet you seem to have a job, but you do not belong here. So that creates anxieties. And that, of course, is not a universal issue, but one person always looks at it from the prism of their own circumstances. So what you're seeing when I think Brexit was something similar, where essentially the people that were on the fringes of the economy were saying, well, I could have had a job at McDonald's, but you were able to get somebody from Estonia or Romania to come and do that job for half the wage. So therefore, they are the reason I've been displaced. So and that's what fueled the tensions that led to Brexit eventually. And I think in South Africa, you're seeing a manifestation of something similar, where you see where the crux of where these problems are where the people feel either marginalized or displaced, particularly economically. And what you're seeing here is that if you then go to a place like France, for example, if you go to the slums of Marseille, you see the people in Algeria, they get there as people who don't have anything, and then they start to make things happen. Similarly, in South Africa, if somebody is going to migrate from Somalia or anywhere else and then say, I finally made it to this land of opportunity, they're going to try and make things happen because they don't have access to state subsidies, they don't have access to state assistance. So for them, the need to actually make things happen is much more acute, and that's how you see them setting up
spaza shops. Survival, right?
Yeah, that's a survival instinct. Now, of course, once they've set up that spaza shop and I'm sitting across the road as a South African, I'm thinking, well, actually, had that person not existed, then perhaps I would have been in a position to do that. Now, of course, the fact that I'm not interested in opening a shop in the first place is not the conversation I'm having. The conversation I'm having is that that person is making it and I'm not, and that person doesn't belong here, so let me get rid of that person. So perhaps some slice of the pie is going to fall my way. It's a very myopic analysis, but unfortunately, we are stuck with it. And until somebody actually educates society to say, well, actually, yes, you can kick out that Somalian across the road, but tomorrow you still won't have the skills to run the business. So what exactly is the point?
But it's not dissimilar to burning trains or burning libraries or all of that type of stuff.
It's kind of a very South African thing. We almost shoot ourselves in the foot.
Yeah, we do that. And I mean, it happened a lot, particularly during FISMA's fall, where, you know, there was a lot of violence that's eventually emanated. And then I said, you know, one of the biggest problems that we have as a country is that we've taught all these children that we got this great victory of apartheid, of defeating apartheid through violent means. And we've never told them how to engage differently and then said, actually,
by the way, it's
this
not,
is different
it
ways.
Also happens to not be true. I mean, there was a negotiated settlement at the end, and the violent means in between, that was certainly part of the reason that eventually the old government decided to capitulate, but it wasn't like it was a military victory.
Yeah, definitely not a military
victory. So we've also got to tell people the truth. And unfortunately, too few people, I mean, you gentlemen obviously notwithstanding, but there are too few people who do actually read and understand the history. Yeah. I mean, my mind is always blown every time I go to places like the Apartheid Museum. And I remind myself of, like, I don't remember the Avia Beer storming the World Trade Center. And then when I see it, I'm like, what? That happened. And remember Botswana. You remember all this stuff. So we have to keep reminding ourselves. And I tend to think that I'm paying attention to history, but I also forget all the time how complicated all of it was. And we just heard a story about how Zoo Lake came about now, which I thought was pretty interesting. Okay, but we're doing ourselves no favor here.
Yeah.
Because as Canton says, we seem to have a one-solution-fits-all protest.
Well,
behavior.
Remember in the case of the xenophobia, we have had a very definite step that's come out of government where there's been this announcement that certain businesses are going to be reserved for South Africans. And you'll see that very quickly extended to things like spaza shops and so forth.
But I think that's terrible. That's protectionism of the worst kind.
Of course it's protectionism. And of course it's going to ultimately lead to higher prices, and it's not going to create more jobs. And like everything that they do, it actually...
I would disagree.
All right, let's hear
just
this.
Because the government has said it doesn't mean they know how to implement it. They don't even know how many of these shops are affected. Literally. So they say that they're going to regulate particular sectors, but I mean, if you walk into a shop and you see the people working at the till and they happen to be South Africans, on what basis do you then say, let me pierce that veil and find out exactly who the ultimate owner of
this company is?
In other
words, we rely on government's incompetence as a way of taking the country forward.
So there's absolutely no such risk, as far as I'm concerned. There's no such risk whatsoever. Don't worry about it.
I totally
agree with this. I have no response to that.
But also, you know, Jane, who works here with us, she lives in Alex, and she came in here the other day in a really lovely outfit, and she said that she managed to get it for a good price in the CBD. And since the xenophobic violence, she hasn't been able to go into the CBD, and she said that all the clothes everywhere else are too expensive. So to your point, Canthan, when you try to do this stuff, when you manipulate the market like this, and our government really thinks they can manipulate the market to do anything they want. They still haven't learned that's not how it happens.
So if what they want is to actually drive the markets downwards, then yes, certainly they're succeeding at that level.
Yeah. So I think the big problem is that we seem to have taken the view that the government understands the consequences to the market of their actions. And I think that is something that probably doesn't exist. So the key issue here is that they are dealing with this burning fire where people have said to the government, the reason that we had this particular outbreaks of xenophobic violence is because you've got these people who are foreigners that are opening up businesses. So government says, well, let us actually then restrict them and say those businesses are only open to South Africans. So for them, they are not taking a position and say, so what happens when you engage in that type of market interference in any form or shape. If you engage in that type of market interference, what becomes the ultimate cost to the consumers themselves? And is this the type of cost that we want to be passing on to the consumers? And what does it achieve? Does the idea of shutting down that shop across the road simply mean that those people are now going to leave the country? Conversely, if you now shut off that shop that is owned by a Somalian with 10 children, for example, that person now no longer has a source of income. That person becomes a bigger burden on the state, one way or another. So there are these perverse consequences that they don't seem to have applied their minds to. And the first question should have been, any form of market interference, should it be countenanced by this particular democratic dispensation? And the answer is no. What they are supposed to be doing is formalizing all these structures and formalizing all these businesses to say, well, actually, in that person across the road, here's their registration, they followed all the rules, here's their liquor license, that's why they're selling alcohol at 2 a.m. and you're buying because you want to. Formalize the system and then leave at that. Do not try to do some form of market interference when you don't understand the market.
Right, and they don't. Like Ibrahim Patel doesn't, as Canton was saying earlier. All right, there are other things we need to talk about. We're going to briefly pay attention to what's going on in the UK because I know this is something that doesn't interest a lot of people, and it is complicated. But I know both of you...
No, it's actually simple.
Well, go on, help us.
Well, essentially, this court ruling that happened this week, which everyone has saying, oh, actually, it's a smackdown for Boris and the Remainers must start rejoicing. No, actually, what it is an affirmation of parliamentary processes, because you need to go through the fine print of the judgment, which is out there. Go to the UK Supreme Court website and take a look at the judgment. And
it says, Canton, you're the only one who does that, so you're going to have to explain it to us.
Well, essentially, what the courts were saying is that in the case of the United Kingdom, the executive is not elected directly by the people. The executive is elected by Parliament. And so any attempt by the executive to actually subvert the ability of Parliament to provide oversight over the executive is contrary to the norms of democracy. And while it's perfectly acceptable in cases such as when they're getting ready for elections or for party political conferences to put Parliament on hold, it turns out that in this particular case, none of those excuses actually apply. And therefore, the removal of the oversight role in terms of what Parliament was doing is illegal.
What about the oversight role of the Queen? I mean,
the oversight role of the Queen.
You just said queer instead of Queen. Can we just stick to Queen Elizabeth? Queen. It sounded like queer.
Okay, I promise you, he said Queen.
Are you sure?
So this is not This is already getting fun. But he apparently either lied to the Queen to get her assent, because she has to assent.
No, the courts said nothing about that whatsoever. The courts ruled entirely on procedure. And this is the point that people don't get. Social media has been going up in arms. Oh, the courts have ruled that he lied to the Queen. No, the courts said nothing about that at all. The courts were actually affirming the oversight role of Parliament. And this is something that we should all actually be saluting, because it shows that you cannot actually subvert the democratic processes in the UK.
All right, that's
a good thing.
I understand that what we've got now is a situation where Boris needs to call an election, but he's not going to get the election because the Labour Party won't let him have the election, because they'll lose the election if they have it now. Is that what's going on?
That's absolutely right. And it's this really absurd thing where Boris has basically been saying from the get-go, let's submit this thing to a democratic process, so let the people actually decide. All of you guys are turning around saying, I don't have a mandate to run this country. So I'm saying, give me an election and let me get a mandate.
And then they say, no, we're not going to give you an election.
Yeah, and the reason why they don't want to give him an election is because all indications are that if they do give him an election, then he will win. And that ultimately is subverting democracy.
I think it's a unique state of affairs where the opposition says, no, we don't want to remove you from office because the risk is that we might not get it. I've never seen anything like that. So the Labour Party simply says, we're simply not going to do that. And I think you need about 435 votes in order to say, yes, let us go to a general election. And he clearly doesn't have anything close to that. So he's literally being held hostage by democracy.
Except there is a wild card that he can play, which is, he can actually call for a no-confidence vote himself.
He tried that yesterday, and they turned it down.
Yeah,
he tried that last night, and the Labour Party says, no, we have confidence in you. Actually, that's what they're saying. An opposition party saying, we've got confidence in you.
Yeah. Okay, but, well, as things happen right now, what this basically means is that by the time you get to the 31st of October, nothing's actually going to happen.
So then we're going to have a no-deal Brexit?
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely nothing can be done right now. I think the timelines are not in his favor, and the appetite for the European bureaucrats to negotiate, particularly with him, has long ago disappeared. I think Theresa May stood a better opportunity of negotiating with Europeans, but Boris having been
but
part of
remember,
the Leave campaign.
Kaya, let's remember that Theresa May was always opposed to Brexit.
Yeah.
So she was always there as a Trojan horse and was trying to actually negotiate a Brexit that wasn't really a Brexit, which is why she lost her
permission. And I suppose that's where the Tories got it wrong in electing somebody who was opposed to something that they had now committed to doing, because the referendum had said they must do it. So there was always going to be the question of, is she really fully committed to the cause, having been against it from the outset? So perhaps we should have had a Boris Johnson before Theresa May, but that...
Well, that was her fundamental screw-up, because she called an election because she thought that she would get a mandate, and people actually said, no, we don't trust you.
Yeah.
And so they lost their majority at the time, and they had to go into this really dubious arrangement with
the SNPs.
With the DUP, in Northern Ireland.
And didn't we have a chance, but the British people, didn't they have a chance to have Boris as a potential prime minister before Theresa? Because after David Cameron resigned, he was definitely himself unavailable.
He made himself unavailable because he was going through a very messy divorce at that point.
Yeah, and he had this habit of going as being the foreign secretary, pissing off foreign governments. So that didn't help at that stage.
But surely that is the job of being foreign secretary, to piss off foreign governments.
It would be your job if you were foreign secretary, Canton, I have no doubt. Okay, let's bring things to the UN quickly, because there was a young lady, 16 years old, called Greta Thunberg, who appeared in front of the UN's Climate Change Action Group. Interestingly enough, these are all countries that are reducing their carbon footprint. I noticed India and China were not present. And they are by far the countries with the largest global carbon emissions at the moment. China in particular is way ahead of everyone else. And that's because their economies are growing.
Absolutely right.
But
also take into account the fact that in both those countries, even though their carbon emissions have been growing, their carbon emissions are actually slowing down at the same time. So, overall it's growing, but it's growing at a reduced rate every year.
So how should we treat this lecture from this young girl who is clearly concerned and very emotional about the climate situation? What should we do in the wake of this? Because it's caused a huge amount of excitement on social media. Her supporters are very excited.
I think we should give her a Nobel Peace Prize and then let's move on.
Okay.
I mean, if we could give a Nobel Peace Prize to Obama.
Obama's one.
I'm very happy with that.
So take it away from Barack Obama, give it to her, and let's move on.
At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. The UN is fundamentally smoke and mirrors when it comes down to it. Let's remember that the basis under which a lot of people have been giving her flack based on the fact that she hasn't been singling out China, she hasn't singled out India, and she hasn't singled out the US.
But she's a little girl. Yeah, why are they giving her flack?
She's a 16-year-old, guys.
No, but the reason for that is that those countries are not signatory to the treaty which allows to hold them accountable.
Plus, as I said earlier, if she did roll into China and try to tell President Xi what to do with his economy,
Tiananmen 1989,
he might roll a tank over her.
Tiananmen 1989.
No, there are a lot more. No, we've spoken about this, guys. Beijing is subtle these days. You know, you'll get put into a suitcase and whisked off to China, and somewhere down the line you'll eventually resurface preaching.
I was surprised the Hong Kong thing lasted as long as it did, because I would have thought Beijing is going to come rolling.
Beijing will not roll into Hong Kong. Beijing plays a long game, and Beijing only needs to wait another 25 years and then they can do whatever they want in Hong Kong.
And they don't mind waiting.
And they don't mind it, because Beijing, the Chinese think in terms of thousands of years.
Yes.
They do forward planning better than anyone else on the planet.
South Africans think in terms of thousands of rands.
Can we talk Iran?
Yes, please, while we're in the international sphere. And then I do want to bring it back, because you two are going to be the ones to explain Peter Moyo and Old Mutual to me.
No, I want to hear Kai on Peter Moyo and Old Mutual, but I do want to talk about Iran, because that's sure. That's stuff that I was actually investigating this week. Mm-hmm. Because, so here's what happened. The Saudi Aramco facilities in two places got blown up.
Yes.
And immediately the Houthis in Yemen claimed responsibility.
But everyone said they couldn't have claimed responsibility because they're not...
Well, actually, the point is that they are technologically capable of it.
Are they?
And if you go back to July, where they had a kind of show and tell for assembled media from around the world, where they actually showed off their drones.
Oh.
And they actually showed that they have the capability of putting these out there. So these drones that they have, essentially, it's about a 400-kilometer... distance from Yemen across to Abqaiq, or however you pronounce it, which is the main facility that was hit. And certainly the drones that they showed off are eminently capable of delivering that particular type of strike.
Okay.
And where did they get the drones from? Well, no doubt they got the drones from the Iranians.
Okay.
But is it actually possible that they launched the drones and not the Iranians? Yes, absolutely. So ultimately, is Iran at the back of it feeding armaments across to them? Well, yes, but Iran's entitled to do that in exactly the same way as the US and UK have been consistently feeding arms across
to Saudi.
Mm. But then the fascinating thing was, I then started taking a look at the inventory that Iran actually has in terms of drones. And one of the fascinating things was, in 2011, there was a US drone that was actually shot down over Iran in territorial waters. And one of the things that they then proceeded to do was to reverse engineer this thing.
Their own one, yeah?
Yes, so they reverse engineered it. It was a Lockheed Martin RQ-170 Sentinel combat drone, carries four precision-guided bombs, and the Iranians reverse engineered it, and then they actually unveiled their own version of it, and they showed it off to the assembled world. And the reason why they shot it, they were able to take it down safely in the first place, is they were actually able to tap into its communication systems so that they could cause it to actually crash land relatively safely so that they could reverse engineer it. Iran has literally thousands of these things. Now, I then did a little exercise in terms of the distance from from the Iranian coastline across to every major oil facility in the Persian Gulf.
They could set the whole Arabian Peninsula on fire.
Within a half hour. So at the point at which...
Regardless of how much armament and ammunition and international backing the Saudis have.
Absolutely, yes.
So this suddenly changes the geopolitical climate in that area quite significantly.
Absolutely. And the
well,
reason
it might have changed it a long time ago. Maybe we're only aware of it now.
Well, the fascinating thing about Upcake, now remember we were talking about Straits of Hormuz not so long back.
Yes.
And Straits of Hormuz is where most of the world's oil actually moves through. And right. Of course, Straits of Hormuz is Iran's territorial waters. So take it for granted that in the event of war, Iran will just simply close the Straits of Hormuz, make it a no-go zone. So what the Saudis have been trying to do in order to bypass this is they built an east-west pipeline that bypasses the Straits of Hormuz and goes all the way across to the far side of the country. And that pipeline starts at Upcake. And essentially, by taking out that facility, the Iranians and their allies have shown that actually, no, you think that you'll still be able to keep the oil flowing if you mess with us. No, that's not going to happen.
Sure.
The scary part, of course, is remember, we don't have the oil reserves because you and Tina sold them off a couple of years ago, didn't you? So I get scared when you talk about this particular prospect of war and the oil supplies no longer flowing. What will happen to us?
Well, what will happen to us is exactly the same thing that we've always done. We'll make a plan.
Who sold our oil reserves? Tina, Jumat Peterson.
Yes.
It was Kantan and Tina.
Okay.
That's what I've been led to believe.
Kantan as well.
I'm open for correction, though.
All right. Well, that is...
Let's remember that in the event of conflagration happening in the Persian Gulf, that leaves two kingmakers in the world. That's essentially going to be Russia and Venezuela.
Oof.
Finally, Venezuela's got something good to say.
Finally.
Well, remember that...
Finally, that communism will pay off.
Someone actually gave me, advanced this theory to me that the reason why the U.S. has been ring-fencing Venezuela and Iran and preventing them effectively selling their oil into the open market is because there's a long-term view that Venezuela and Iran are strategic oil reserves for the U.S.
Mm.
So shut them off from being able to sell their oil right now, and at the point at which all of the rest of the Middle Eastern oil from purported allies has run out, then you simply roll in and take control of those oil fields and they become yours.
Well, didn't Trump say at the U.N. just this week that we're now the biggest producer of oil and gas in the world?
Well, actually speaking, that's correct, but that's because 50% of the Saudi oil production was knocked out. Remember that taking out those two facilities in Saudi was 5% of the oil production of the world.
Yeah,
it's 6.5 million barrels per day that comes out of those places.
Wow.
And to put that in perspective, we in South Africa, we use about 600,000 barrels a day.
Sure. That's unreal.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Peter Moyo and Old Mutual because I do not understand it and I hope you can explain it to me, Kaya.
There's nothing left to understand,
it's
you
the
know.
The third time that they've gone back to the building for him to reassume his job as CEO. It's all very dramatic. It's like a big play that they're acting out.
Yeah.
But what's actually happening? I mean, what went on here? What's the real story?
Look, what went on is the version of the story that nobody nobody wants to tell. I'm still convinced that we haven't been told what the fundamental story is. Mm-hmm. But what we are aware of is that the two egos in the boardroom, being Trevor and Peter, had a clash. And the consequence of that clash is that the entire company is being dragged down to it. So both of them suffer from multiple conflicts of interest. Now, the conflicts of interest relating to Peter Moyo is the fact that he owns a private investment company in his own name, well, with a couple of other directors, and Old Mutual is invested in that company. So you already have a red flag there, because the question is, if he's sitting in a boardroom in a board meeting of that particular company, who does he represent? Does he represent himself as a director of that company, or does he represent Old Mutual's interests, and how does he manage that? So Old Mutual had this brilliantly stupid idea that if you put somebody else in the room who says I'm also from Old Mutual, that then mitigates the risk. The problem is that the person that they put in there just happens to be Peter Moyo's employee. So imagine sitting in this room and Peter says, this is what I want to do. And then this guy says, no, that's not in Old Mutual's interest. So I'm not going to do it. And then tomorrow morning, they're busy negotiating that person, the particular employee's bonus. It was always a big mess up. Yeah. That's where it started.
Stupid.
So what seems to have really broken the camel's back was the fact that there was a long-standing understanding between gentlemen, if you want to call it that, that in spite of the fact that legally particular amounts were due to Old Mutual on an annual basis, Old Mutual was always happy to defer those repayments. And this is an unwritten agreement, but it's just the way things have always worked. Now, in this particular instance, it then turns out that long before the gentleman's conversation was had, Peter Moyo and his team sat around and did particular distributions. And then Old Mutual found out and said, but you distributed money to yourself.
ourselves when we were entitled to the first distribution because we are the preferred shareholders. On what basis did you do that? And Peter's thinking seems to be, well, our long-standing gentleman's agreement means that I was just going to come and say, can we defer again? And you guys would have said yes anyway. And then the answer is like, no, actually, we wouldn't have said yes. That seems to be the crux of the matter. So that's where it all started. And then they engaged in this very bad PR exercise where they suspended him. And the moment they suspended him, that's when Trevor Manuel became central to the picture because he started screwing up spectacularly. So he firstly says on the 24th of May...
But people think Trevor's just the most genius man that's ever lived. He made our economy grow, didn't he?
I told you the problem in South Africa is that they don't travel widely enough for a start. So that basis for thinking that Trevor is a genius is probably founded on their inability to understand what it takes to make a genius. So the big problem seems to be in the first letter of suspension that they issued out to the market on the 24th of May, they said he had done nothing wrong. So he's done nothing wrong. He's suspended from work. And then weeks later, they then fire him. So question one would be, if a person hasn't done anything wrong when they're at work, what could they have possibly done when they're not at work that then warrants a dismissal? So Old Mutual now started losing control of what it is that they're trying to do. So for them, then they serve him with a letter of dismissal. And then he says, but according to my employment contract, I'm entitled to a process, a disciplinary process before you fire me. And then Old Mutual is like, no. We are not going to engage in that. And then the court goes back to the contract. The contract says explicitly, yes, he's entitled to the particular process. And Old Mutual decided not to engage in that process. So then the court says, okay, because you've broken your own contract and, you know, your own processes, you must reinstate this man on that basis. So it simply said that the process you undertaken of dismissing him was invalid. So therefore, you must get him his job back. And then Old Mutual says, no, we disagree with that judge because Old is just is a man who's wearing a robe. So then they start appealing that process. But now there's this question of when they're appealing that process, does it mean he can or cannot go back to work? And there seems to be no consensus around that. But so that's why he keeps going back and forth.
But he really doesn't want to go back to work. He just wants some kind of payout.
No, the point is, at the end of the day, we know it's really going to end up in Peter's bank account. This conversation is going to end up in Peter's bank account. It's perhaps a matter of the lessons that we're learning in terms of corporate governance and even company law, because this is unknown territory for a lot of people. Nobody knows who's in the right. Now, obviously, each attorney representing each party seems to believe that they're on the right, but it looks like the law seems to be favoring more your side, and I think Old Mutual's lawyers have been very, very clumsy in handling this. There was this one particular letter that they issued where they said, yes, we acknowledge that Mr. Moyo is actually conducting work, but we're simply saying he doesn't have to do it in the building. But this is the same person that they're now saying, but we had fired that person, so therefore he can't come into the building. And then when he went to court last week, he said, well, these people are in contempt of court because the court said to them, they must reinstate me based on that flawed process. And guess what? They subverted that process by issuing another letter. So this letter is an evidence that they're in contempt of court. Now, Old Mutual said that that letter was irrelevant in the court. And then yesterday, they're using that same letter to say you can't come into the building. And then everyone's like, but you went to the court and said that letter was irrelevant. The court disagreed and said, no, this letter is relevant. So the letter has been admitted as part of the court proceedings. But now the problem is that Old Mutual says yesterday, oh, he can't come in because that second letter says that he's been dismissed. 2 days before, they had said that that letter is relevant in a court.
So Old Mutual's really, their lawyers are doing them no favors.
Well, the lawyers are also getting rich in the process.
Yeah, yeah, so they're not getting poor. That's the key thing.
And shouldn't these lawyers be fired for being so crap at what they're
doing? No. The problem with lawyers is that they get into a room and this person, who is the chairperson of the board of Old Mutual, says, this is the answer that I want. And then they give him the answer that he wants. So at the end of the day, the lawyers will be like, well, you asked us if this was possible. Of course, the answer is always yes, as far as the lawyers are concerned. Remember, lawyers have got this wonderful thing of plausible deniability. We thought it was possible based on our understanding of the law. How were we to know that the opposing counsel was going to come up with the superior argument? So we told you what we thought was going to work. So that's literally the nonsense that you drag yourself through. So this is why we still have this legal impasse where literally Old Mutual need to take a step back and say, well, Peter Moyo is going to go, but why delay and prolong the process, and at what cost to your own reputations as directors of Old Mutual and to the reputation of the company itself? And they're also falling for his PR trap. Of course, Peter Moyo knew they were not going to let him into the building, but guess what? When we then eventually get to court and he says they've been in contempt of a court application, he's like, I tried 3 times to honor this court directive that said I must go back to work, and each of those 3 times I was marshaled out of the building.
And surely of course, media has been very happy to go along with it.
Of course.
But fundamentally, he was right. What he said from the get-go is that we need to sit around the table and actually resolve this.
Yeah.
And that comes to your point in terms of, ultimately, this is a financial decision, and he does need to be paid in order to walk. And I would be doing exactly the same thing if I were in his position. Although I don't know how one actually ends up in that scenario where you're actually sitting on the board of two companies and one is... what a clusterfuck.
Well, he learned from his chairman, because Old Mutual's chairperson, Trevor Manuel, does the same thing. He was the deputy chair of Rothschild and also the chairman of Old Mutual, only for Rothschild to win the tender to tell Old Mutual how to separate its businesses, which is in itself a conflict of interest. But of course, they always tell us that, no, we managed it. We don't know what that means.
Oh, this is such a lovely story. Kaya, you need to do a Venn diagram that's actually showing how these various things come together.
Yeah, look at it in tab board and the things that they do.
Someone's going to pay him, Peter Moyle, money to draw that Venn diagram. It's that complicated.
Ask Trevor.
Yeah. All right. Here's an interesting little, what do you call this? Almost like an infographic that's been sent round. Here are the nationalized entities that we currently have in South Africa. Eskom, bankrupt. SABC, bankrupt. SAA, bankrupt. PetroSA, bankrupt. Danel, bankrupt. Post Office, bankrupt. PRASA, bankrupt.
So the answer is that we need a national bank. See, that's the solution.
There we go.
Because if everybody's bankrupt, let's just have a bank that's just going to remove the rapt from all of these things, and then we're going to get sorted. Interestingly, what's missing from that list is an entity called AXA. So AXA has been around for, I think, around 26 years, and only once have they failed to make a profit. They always make a profit.
The airports company,
the airports company of South Africa. Mm-hmm. So the question is why? And the answer is very simple. AXA is lucky in that AXA operates in a space where there are so many international competitors. AXA is in a position to say, these are the lending fees we are charging Emirates, so therefore we're going to charge the same thing to SAA. In other entities, you've got that political decision-making power that interferes and says, you'd like to sell that in the open market for that amount of money, but no, the people cannot afford it, so therefore you cannot charge the price that you want. It's the same fiasco we're seeing with the SABC TV licenses, whether you like it or not. I mean, if you've decided that you're going to have a license regime, you cannot cap those licenses at 275 rand for 10 years. It just makes no sense. So AXA is very lucky in the fact that because it has this diverse client list of people that actually understand how the market works, it is able to charge the right prices and therefore remain financially sustainable. These other entities are unfortunately not being used to ensure that form of sustainability works. And that's
except,
a great
except financially sustainable, let's take into account that by all standards, AXA's lending fees are vastly overpriced, which is why we've suddenly seen a boom in terms of Lanceria, which has significantly lower.
It's growing, hey?
Yeah, it's significantly
and
lower.
And Lanceria does not belong to AXA?
Correct.
There's a part owned by the PIC in particular. How the people that then ended up with the BE stake of it ended up with it is a story for another day.
One of those BE deals that we will never...
You know how the PIC works.
Yeah, well, we don't. What's happening there, by the way? Because we had all of those commissions of inquiry and those hearings at the PIC.
The wonderful thing about commissions of inquiry is that for as long as you are participating in the inquiry and you're writing the report, you're getting paid every single day. So do not expect there to be an urgency in them saying, okay, we've heard all the testimony, this is the final conclusion. So that report is going to take forever to be finalized. But as we know, there's no CEO, there's no CFO, and there's also apparently no one who understands governance in the entire structure. There's a new board that's just been put in place. It has Maria Ramos, and of course, Maria Ramos is married to Trevor Manuel, and the PIC has got a stake in Old Mutual. You know how the story goes.
Oh my God. Is there any reason that we have to believe that maybe somewhere in the next couple of months we're going to see some kind of economic growth, some kind of change in the economy? Is there any kind of indication that we might be heading towards like at least a nice Christmas for people? Please give us some hope.
Are we talking about South Africa?
Yeah.
No. Well, we've been speaking about a different country, so I just had to make sure that you're asking about the Republic of South Africa, and the answer is no.
No, straight away.
No, absolutely not. Remember, how these things happen is that economic growth is a byproduct of making difficult and very critical decisions long in advance. We don't have a president with the courage to make the important decisions. So, for example, if you've decided that perhaps tourism, you're talking about December, if you've decided that tourism is where you want the boom to come from, then of course you go back and you look at everything that Malusi Gigaba ever touched at Home Affairs and then you burn it overnight. We haven't done that. So you'd have to be actually making very important decisions long in advance in order for you to then benefit from the byproduct decisions.
Kaya, I must actually interrupt at this point. It actually requires that you make decisions, whether they're important or not. And this is a president who's incapable of making any decisions.
Yeah. I mean, the most fascinating thing is that 5 months ago, the JSC had hearings, interviews for constitutional court judges, and then on the same day, they gave him the list. And it took him 5 months to decide on who to appoint.
And absolutely nobody can understand why it would take you 5 months when you actually no longer have anything to do. You've been told these are the only candidates that are appointable. Just pick 2 out of 5. It can't be the most difficult thing. And yet it took him all of 5 months to do so. And unfortunately, by the time he made that decision, there was another vacancy because Justice Cameron retired during that particular interregnum. And now you've got yet another vacancy. And given the fact that it takes him 5 months to make a decision, well, it's not even making a decision because he had to choose names from a decision that had been made. So it's not like somebody said, yeah, you must sit down with them and interview them. They simply said, these are the people, just take a pick, one, two, or three. It doesn't matter who it is because they've all been vetted by us. And it took him 5 months to apply his mind to that list of five.
So
now imagine trying to run an entire economy.
Like, I thought Cyril was a reasonably smart human being. What is he applying his mind to that's keeping him so busy at the moment?
I never agree with Ernst Lutz on anything, but he did say something quite interesting in that a lot of the people say that we thought he was smart simply because we thought Zuma was not smart. Is it a standalone test? Is it a standalone assessment? Or is it simply a comparative assessment? Because that's the big issue that you're dealing with here. A lot of people say that he's better, not because he was the best president that you could put out there, but because it looked like he'd be better than the previous guy. So that becomes half the problem.
And in the land of the blind, the one-eyed is king.
That is the issue here.
I've never accused Zuma of not being smart.
I've always yeah, he held us all by the balls for 9 years, didn't
he? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that takes some smart.
I always used to say, underestimate Jacob Zuma at your peril. And to this day, he still continues to hold sway behind the scenes at a large extent.
Yeah, that's it. I wish you had told somebody called Thabo Mbeki that many years ago.
But what is he spending his time doing? Do we have any idea of what this president's up to at the moment? Where is he so preoccupied? He's, you know...
President Ramaphosa.
Yeah.
Well, yesterday he was appeasing his core constituency. He was at the SATU conference, opening the SATU conference, and he made particular promises to them that he's never going to deliver on. So one of the promises that he made is that he's going to improve security at schools. Now, be aware that in the schools that are owned by the state, there's over 22,000 of them. Security is actually not a fundamental feature. So you don't walk to a school and find that there's 3 dedicated security guards.
No, you can walk straight in.
So when he said yesterday that he's going to improve security, they all cheered and then are sitting there in absolute horror. I'm like, wait a minute. On what basis do you think that the president is going to execute on that? Because there isn't actually a dedicated security services portfolio that says in every school, here's the baseline number of security features that we're going to have. This is what I'm going to do to improve it. And they all sat there and they cheered. And I'm thinking, they've been in the education system. They've seen this every single day. Tomorrow, they're going to walk into their own schools and there'll be not a single security guard. And that cheering person just said that this is going to be improved. I don't know, bro.
He also said, and this is quite disturbing, he said that you teachers must please stop having sex with the students.
Yeah, they're not your lovers. I think that's what he said.
You are their parents, they are not your lovers.
Remarkably ill-conceived comments because it gives the impression that, look, if you weren't teachers, then of course we wouldn't have a problem. But of course, the issue here is that these are old people, these are old men preying on young children. And there was a report last week that said, was it 6,000 in the Northwest alone? Children, girls,
pregnancies
have been pregnant, and some as young as 11 years old. And you're thinking, how on earth is this allowed to happen? And that's one province where we must say the data isn't always up to speed. So even that 6,000 is definitely an underestimate. So if you can see the scale of the crisis using just the Northwest data alone, the president couldn't just say, oh, guys, stop being lovers to the children in the class. It is simply inadequate.
It's a heavy thing to end it on, but that's all we got time for this morning. Thank you both very much.
So you don't
much.
Want to impeach Trump this morning?
Well, do you think that there's any chance in hell they're going to certainly get it through Congress, but they won't win in the Senate, so it's moot.
Not going to happen.
It's merely
you need 2/3 to get it through Senate, and it's not going to happen.
So it's play acting.
Good optics, good politics, but it was just going to derail them ahead of the 2020 election, which is now on the 8th of November, I believe.
So I had this conversation with someone. I really wasn't going to go Trump, but now you've pulled me in, you see, Canton. Someone said to me, what do you think the result will be for the Democrats in the 2020 elections? And I said, it's going to hit them very hard. It's going to actually hurt their chances in 2020. Because first of all, let's just remember that at this stage, it's either going to be Elizabeth Warren or Joe Biden. And Joe Biden is the
same. I wish it could be Kamala Harris. I like her. But anyway,
well,
it's not going
to
happen.
I don't know what's to like, but I'll give it to you.
She's a nice person.
Really?
And Joe Biden is probably one heartbeat away from a faulty heart attack.
I popped out the other day during the presidential debate. But the fact is, like, Biden's their safe bet. He's the guy who can win just enough votes and it wouldn't be too much. He'd be able to trot in there and he wouldn't have to work too hard. But this whole thing with Ukraine that has brought on this impeachment discussion, Joe Biden's in the same position, effectively. There isn't sufficient evidence at this stage on either side to prove that there's a quid pro quo situation with the president or at Joe Biden's stage, vice president.
I think Joe Biden should call Jacob Zuma for advice, because remember, it's his son who's actually the business
person.
And, you know,
Hunter Biden.
We've got evidence of how you manage this thing. So just put your son there as a proxy and then claim plausible deniability. You can learn a lot from Mr. Zuma.
But what is true is that if it ends up being Elizabeth Warren, and I've noticed that the Democratic media machine has now been very strongly pushing a narrative around Elizabeth Warren. And I think that they're actually now afraid about this entire Biden thing kind of unraveling. So, and what's really going to happen is that when she pops up as candidate, Trump is simply going to resort to falling back on his Pocahontas narrative. And that ultimately is going to carry it for him. The guy is sitting with a 90% approval rating among Republican voters. But remember that ultimately, if you're getting a 90%
this
approval,
despite the Never Trumpers and Mitt Romney and people like that saying, oh no, they think impeachment's not entirely a bad idea.
Absolutely right. And remember that right now among Democrats, the possibility of you even admitting the possibility that you might vote for Trump is non-existent at a public level. But if you're still able to have the opinion poll saying there's 90% support among Republicans, then just take the view that of all of those who are not speaking out, there's a significant chunk of them as well who are not expressing their support for Trump at this point, but they will end up voting for him.
And also, haven't the Democrats been banging this drum for the longest time? The whole Russia collusion thing, which completely failed on them. The Kavanaugh stuff, which failed on them. It seems that there's a lot of stuff that and the New York Times just last week, by the way, or the week before, came out with a complete nonsense story on Kavanaugh. There's a book that's been written by two New York Times reporters in which they basically exonerated the guy, but the headline was that there's another scandal. Obviously, this is nonsense. The Democrats keep on doing this. Their smoke and mirrors are having less and less effect every time.
Yeah, it is an ongoing problem. And I think perhaps it is a learning lesson for the Democrats themselves about what you might call the limitations of their own democracy. Because, you know, whenever there's this big gap between what people think should happen and what, you know, society feels ought to happen and what actually happens, it always intrigues me. Because then you have to go back and say, what type of system have we created? Because we are now saying that there's universal uproar about how this man is conducting himself, and yet he remains firmly ensconced in the White House. So the question should be, what is the system and is it the ideal system? And the impeachment process, of course, it's going to be very good optics for the Democrats if they even get it that far. But nothing will come out of it, because the answer will simply be, well, the Republicans are definitely not going to endorse a democratic process. This is not Britain, where the opposition is the one that says we've got confidence in you. That US politics are far too polarized for that. There's never going to be a meeting of the minds across the floor.
All right.
Any thoughts about gender neutral Barbie dolls?
No, but there was a
well
case.
You did say Barbie, so I'm already lost.
There was a case in the UK this week, and maybe we will end on this because it's at least slightly more humorous, where a transgender man, in other words, a woman who became a man, had a baby and then didn't want to be registered as the mother. And the High Court in the UK said, I'm terribly sorry, but you're the mother.
I need to get out of this.
So there we go.
Mom's the word.
All right. Thank you all very much. Yeah. That is The Burning Platform this week. It's brought to you by Nando's. Certainly not a boring day. And Kai, it's great to see you again. Thank you. You always, every time you come in here, people scream and shout and say, we want you again. So you're
awkward.
I don't know what you've done. Yeah. you don't get like Socrates and leave the room when there's applause.
First person who's properly broken down this entire old mutual thing.
Yeah, thank God, because I still don't understand it, but I think I got a bit closer.
There's a lot of
to,
egos involved.
Yeah, massive, huh?
That's a big issue there.
Trevor. There we go. All right. Thank you very much. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 8 o'clock. And Canton, thank you again, as always. Thank you for joining us. And you can always get hold of us, gareth@cliffcentral.com. And any of the stuff that you heard this morning, available on podcast. Don't forget, download our Pure Conversations from last night. You got an honorable mention there too, Canton. I think it was Bonang and Unati who both said very nice things about you.
Well, I have fond memories of them working for me back in my YFM days.
In fact, they said they put you in a group of men who they respected and admired and who didn't belong in the Me Too camp. So you wipe your brow. All right, you're in good company. CliffCentral.com.